This is the Digital Marketing Experts Podcast episode. Why am I trying to sound like a radio announcer? Experts in the Wire, episode 45. Pamela Wilson. Hey everyone, welcome to episode 45 of Experts on the Wire. My guest today, Pamela Wilson, she's going to help us create better content, get more clicks, keep your readers' attention, and get more marketing and business results from that. Pamela Wilson is the Executive Vice President of Educational Content at Rainmaker Digital. Now, Rainmaker is kind of the umbrella company that sits above Copyblogger, which I'm sure many of you have heard of. I recommend you check out Copyblogger. They've got a lot of great stuff about copywriting and marketing. You can, of course, go to evolvingseo.com/wire to sign up for the email list, where you will get the show notes directly in your inbox when every new episode posts. You get all the links, resources, and you can write back to me. I probably will reply to you. With that, let's get into episode 45 of Experts on the Wire with Pamela Wilson. As I was telling you before we started the call, I came across your article that talked about Copyblogger's redesign. You added comments back on, which I was very happy with, and I know you had a lot to do with that, so I can't wait to talk to you about it. But sometimes that's how I find guests, is I'd seen you around the web a little bit, but when I saw that article and read your comments and your take on that, on Copyblogger's redesign, I knew I had to get you on the show, and I think I even left you a voicemail. And that was a complete spontaneous thing. I did that right then and there. So thank you so much for joining us. I first want to ask, your title is Executive VP of Educational Content at Copyblogger. What exactly does that mean?
So it's actually at Rainmaker Digital nowadays. So that officially is like, that's a title that you have to like take a breath in the middle of so you can get through it, you know. So what it means is I am in charge of right now I am running the editorial team for Copyblogger, which is our, you know, most trafficked property, basically. So kind of setting the direction for the content that we publish there and overseeing all of that. And then I'm also very involved in creating educational products. So mostly on the Copyblogger side of the business, which is our authority content marketing training program. And then we also have a program called the Certified Content Marketers Program, which is advanced content marketing education for people who are positioning themselves as professional writers.
Mm-hmm. And you were originally not a writer. You were a designer. So
I just wrote a book. So I wrote this book called Master Content Marketing. And one of the reasons I wanted to write it is that I had started out in 2010 bringing all my professional experience as a designer to content marketing. I didn't feel qualified to write at all. So back in those days, I had started my own site, Big Brand System, and I knew I wanted to use content marketing and started learning everything I could about content marketing. And as you can imagine, a very quick web search led me to Copyblogger, and that's how I started reading and getting involved with their content. Eventually, that led to guest posting for them, and eventually, they invited me to join the team a couple of years ago. So I went from someone who, if something needed to be written, I got on the phone and called someone to hire them to write it.
Yeah.
To being someone who now teaches content marketing, which I still can't believe it. It happened in about 5 years.
Do you find that there were parallels in your experience as a designer? And let me ask, actually, is that your official educational background? Did you go to design school, or how did you get to that? Were you always a creative person? How did that happen?
Yeah, I think I was always a creative person. I did go to a school. I got a degree in visual communication. So it was still communication, but it was the visual end of communication. And I was, and I think I still am, pretty good at that. But I do see parallels. Is that what you were asking?
Yeah. So to give a little background, the listeners know I mention this all the time, but I went to music school. I have a degree in classical piano performance, and my dad's a professional sculptor. So I have these parallels as well, and they actually even help me do my SEO work. So I'm curious for you if there's any parallels or things that helped you from what you know as a designer, and then bringing that into writing.
I'm so excited you're talking about this because my son is a musician.
Yeah.
And I see all sorts of parallels between all of those creative pursuits. I think when you're thinking specifically about the parallels between design and writing, a lot of what you do in design is bringing some kind of order, visual order, to information. So you're making information easier to understand by bringing some kind of visual order to it. You apply, we call it visual hierarchy. So you try to make it easy for people to understand what order they should be reading the information, and you're trying to kind of direct their eyes down the page.
Yes.
Same thing with good writing. Really, good writing has a structure, and it's one of the things I talked about a lot in my book, was how to give your content some kind of structure so that it's, first of all, easier for you to write, but then it's also easier to read and consume and understand. Because content marketing, I mean, people need to be able to get in and out of it kind of quickly, right? They're not sitting down with a cup of tea and, you know, paging through a book, sitting in their easy chair. They're like trying to read it quickly. They're trying to get information out of it quickly. So anything you can do to make that reading experience faster and more effective for the person consuming the content is a huge plus.
Yeah, absolutely. So I do have specific questions about kind of the UX of content when we get into talking about copy blogger, where I wanted to begin with some sort of the tactics and the advice that I want to give to the listeners is, you just wrote a post on Smart Blogger. I think it's new, Writing for Beginners. So we'll link to it in the show notes. And interestingly, by the way, I just consulted for Smart Blogger for John and for Tim for some of their SEO. They rebranded and they were concerned about losing traffic. So I think I had actually seen your article before, or even was helping them figure out how to get rich snippets with some of their content. So anyways, it's funny how things kind of connect in ways you don't realize. But what I'd love to do is walk through the three types of users you talk about in this article. And what I really love in it, and maybe you can just, I'll give you a chance to kind of set up what this article is about, but I'd love to walk through these questions that you're posing for each type of reader. And then, and you can talk us through that. But first, set up this article. What's the whole premise of writing for beginners in this article on Smart Blogger?
So the interesting thing is, John, you know, John is a headline geek, right? We know this about John. This is one of the things we love about John, is that he's such a headline geek. So he gave that article a new headline. That article was actually an excerpt from the book I wrote. It's a chapter in the book.
Okay.
So what he did in his headline is he really focused on the beginner aspect of it. And that is one of the points that I make in that chapter, is the thing is, as you write content, you naturally become more knowledgeable about your topic. Mm-hmm. One of the best ways, we all know, one of the best ways to master a topic is to teach it.
Yes.
So in teaching the topic, you tend to become more knowledgeable about it. And what happens is sometimes you kind of forget what it's like to be a beginner in that topic. So you naturally end up writing these higher level posts, which are great, but there are a lot of beginners. There are more beginners than there are intermediate and advanced users. People tend to drop off. You know, their interest wanes about a topic, and they may not want to take it to the advanced level. So one of the things I talk about in that chapter is, don't forget about your beginners. You have to keep serving them, you know.
And is the context of that, are you talking about thinking about if you run a website like CopyBlogger or like SmartBlogger, that you're thinking about your audience as a whole, and as your site evolves and improves and gets better, you don't want to forget that segment of users, the beginners.
Right. So the original chapter title was Matching Your Content to Your Customer's Journey. John was smart to change it because he gave it a title that was, you know, more clickable, which is good. I think it's a perfect title for a book chapter, but for a blog post, he was smart to change it.
Yeah.
But that gives you some context about what really the chapter is about, which is that when people hit your content, they have different questions in mind, different thoughts in their heads, and they're looking for different things. And you have to make sure that as you write content, you're writing content to answer those different questions. So do you want to talk about the questions?
Yeah, I would love to do that. I found this super tactical. And so you break things into three categories, the beginner, the intermediate, and advanced. And then, talk us through that. So what's, for the beginner, what are the questions we're posing? And then how does that present the answers or the articles that you would give for them?
Yeah. And just to give it some context, this is something that we did on Copyblogger and in the editorial team, because we found that it just helped us to keep in touch with what we were producing, and we wanted to make sure that we weren't leaving any group out. So one of the things that we do is we have a Trello board. Our posts get fed into this Trello board, and at the end of each editorial meeting, we go through and we label, you know, this post, how did this, because sometimes, well, you know how it is. Posts are being edited up to the last day before publication. So, you know, we wait until it's published and we kind of look back and we say, was this more advanced, more intermediate, more beginner? And we try to make sure there's always a mix.
Yeah.
So that's one of the, you know, like Monday morning quarterbacking moves that we do. All right. So the three levels. So it's a beginner, intermediate, and advanced. And the beginner has one question in mind. And the question is, what is your topic? So they, you know, in your case, they may be saying like, what exactly is SEO? Like, what does that stand for? Which to us sounds like kind of a ridiculous question, right? But what I say is people are doing a web search about it because they're too embarrassed to ask that question face to face with someone. And, you know, it's like, you're kidding. You don't know what SEO is, right? They don't want that response. So they're doing a web search because they honestly don't even know what the thing is. So what I say to people is you have this beautiful opportunity to define your topic the way you want in the minds of these beginners. So the beginner content is really important. And the beginner typically is kind of at the top of the funnel, right? So you do have to keep serving those people because that's where your intermediate and advanced users typically come from, is from that pool of beginners.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I love having a specific question that you can then think about how you would answer, because it helps dictate the content and even give you ideas for content.
Right.
And of course, all the listeners know you can go to a tool called Answer the Public and get all those question keywords. You're nodding your head.
Yes.
You know that tool.
I love that tool. Yeah. I think the best thing about that tool is that guy at the beginning who's waiting for you to type your question in, looking annoyed, right? So, that's a great tool. So that's the beginner in it. And like I said, I think it's an opportunity to decide how you will define this for your audience. And then we move into intermediate. So intermediate readers, they know what your topic is. Like, they understand what SEO is. They get it. But they want to learn how to do it. Like, they're in kind of a tactile phase where they want to interact with the topic. They actually want to start using it. So the intermediate reader loves tutorials. They love how-to posts, list posts that have, you know, five tips for doing this thing or doing that thing. That tends to be perfect content for that intermediate reader. They just eat that stuff up.
Right? In the post, you have a little section where you say, let's take a look at our website about helping non-runners learn to run. That's your example in the post, is you're using this example of somebody that doesn't run. They're trying to learn how to do it. Then you have a section that says post ideas to answer the how do I blank question or how do I run question. Then you have some bullet points. What kind of shoe offers the best support for running hills? Like, what are these questions here representing in the post?
So those are, for example, they're people who have decided, okay, I know what running is. I know the advantages to running. I want to go ahead and start doing it.
Right.
Like, now I want to put this information into action in my life. So now I need tutorials, like what should my warm up be, or, you know, how can I train for my first 5K? Like, they need to know some basic tutorials on how to get started actually using the topic that you talk about.
Got it. So these questions are kind of subsets of the how do I. So somebody that's saying, what are the best apps to map my run? That's sort of a subset of how do I run better? Because now they're in the weeds looking for that app. Great. Got it. And then moving on to the advanced, what's the question that the advanced readers are asking?
So the advanced readers, they know what the topic is. They have started making that topic part of their lives in one way or another. Now they want to get better at it. They want to get really good at it. So the advanced reader, for example, in our running example, they may be looking at a half marathon. Like they're taking this seriously and they want to achieve mastery. That's basically what it is. So these advanced readers are ripe for becoming customers for like a paid solution that you might have. Mm-hmm. And advanced content can show them that you really know your stuff and you can get them to the point that they really can achieve mastery.
What's an example of an advanced reader for copy blogger? What are the things they're trying to problems they're trying to solve?
Yeah, I mean, advanced readers for us are people who are probably professional writers. They're professional content marketers working for an organization in like a department, or they are freelance writers who are selling their services. Those would be our advanced readers, people who are doing it at the pro level, basically, and they're looking to us for the latest tips about what's working now and encouragement and tips about running their businesses. We've run some posts this year. I ran a freelance business. It was a design business, but the lessons very much cross over to running a freelance writing business. So I've shared some posts on how to set up a retainer relationship, how to do your pricing and things like that. So that's the advanced readers want information like that. It's the advanced information, you're not going to have as much of it. And it's really just this side of paid information. It's like, you know, borderline something you could charge for, but maybe not quite there.
Yeah, that makes sense. The last section in this article I want to highlight is, I love this tip that you give to notice objections and write answers to them. And so, do you have the post open in front of you right there? Can you go through some examples of these objections and then what the content could be off of that?
I'll tell you, I don't have the post open in front of me, but if you want to read a couple off, I'd be happy to comment on them.
Oh, sure.
I opened up a ton of stuff before I got on with you, and that was one thing I did not.
Yeah,
so.
Not a problem. Sorry to put you on the spot there. So No problem. Yeah, one you give is, so this is somebody saying, your potential reader saying, I'll never be a runner. I'm too out of shape. And then the content answer to that is 5 inspiring examples of great runners who don't look like typical athletes. I love that because I'm always looking for ways to come up with content ideas, number one. But number two, now you're looking at what the person is objecting to, the problem that they have, the sort of the wall that they've hit, and then giving a solution to that. And I think I kind of give my own input on what you were supposed to do there. But let me read one more, and then you can give your input on it. So somebody else might say, I don't have time to run. So they're just claiming they can't fit it in their schedule. And then the content answer to that is a simple way to run daily and still have all the time you need. Why does that one work?
Yeah. You know, the thing is those two that you just highlighted, those are almost universal objections for any business. Mm. So I just can't do it. Like, this information is for other people, but not for me. It's like me 5 years ago saying, like, I'm not a writer. Like, I'm not a writer. I'm never going to be a writer. But I got past that, right? So I think, you know, for those of us who have online businesses that are based on teaching, we have to get past this objection of, well, I can't do that. I'm not capable. My site, Big Brand System, teaches design basics. That's one of the things that I teach on that site. And I forever hear people saying, I can't draw a straight line. Like, I'm not creative that way. I'm not artistic at all, you know? So, and I think every site that teaches information has some version of that I'm not capable issue. And then the other issue is time. I think all of us are time pressed. So this idea that you would be able to teach people something, some way that they could incorporate this knowledge in their lives without having to, you know, carve out time that they basically feel like they don't have already, that's very appealing. And that's an objection that almost every business needs to meet one way or another.
Yeah, I love that. You can almost take your title or content examples from that post and use it in a different industry or kind of change it a little bit.
That's why I wrote them that way, Dan.
Yeah, yeah, I like that. So I want to talk a little bit about titles, actually. I've noticed, now, do you write your own titles for Copyblogger, or do they have an editor come in and change them on you, or are they're written like you write them?
Yeah, we write them. We have an editor-in-chief, Stephanie Flaxman, and I, and we spend a lot of time on those headlines. So, okay.
So I'm in BuzzSumo. I'm looking at your most shared pieces of content from the last year. I'm going to read a few of these titles because I'm a fan of, in fact, on Moz 4 years ago, I wrote something about how to make your titles exceptionally click-worthy or whatever. So I'm a huge fan of this too. You have one that says, so many tactics, so little time, how to prioritize your content marketing to-do list. The next one is, are you cheap?
That was me.
Yeah, yeah.
That's good. That's good.
Yeah. Yeah. These are all your titles. These are your most shared posts from Copyblogger. The next one you have is, are you cheap or are you exceptional? How to price your services. This third one I love, why lazy people make the best content marketers. That really hits home for me.
Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing is that concept made it into the book that I wrote.
Oh, really? Lazy people?
I almost ended up calling the book The Lazy Approach to Content Marketing.
Oh, yeah.
Because so much of what's in the book is it's trying to make it doable, because you and I know that the only way to have impact with your content is to do it consistently, to publish consistently, to make sure you're publishing consistently good quality content, right?
Yeah.
And that's hard. I mean, it's like a long slog, right? So I am big on systems, coming up for system with systems and processes that will make the whole thing easier. So what I was going to say is a lot of the concepts that ended up in the book were things that I was thinking about publicly on the pages of Copyblogger. Right. So that was definitely one of them.
It's like a testing ground. I think somebody, Jason Fried, I was watching an interview of him the other day, and he commented how it's like comedians. They test the material in the small clubs for the whole year, and then they do their big special at the end. I like that analogy. And then one last one of yours I want to read is the 79-year master plan for becoming unforgettable. And that's a great title too. So do you have a process for titles specifically? How does it work for you? Does the topic come and then that's the title and then you just create under that? Or do you write the thing and then you've come up with a title afterwards?
I typically come up with a working title first.
Okay.
And sometimes that working title makes it all the way through the writing process and it stays. But sometimes I get to the end of the piece and I say, I need to change the title, because sometimes, I mean, you know how it is. Sometimes the piece ends up taking a slight pivot from where you started, right? Yeah. So my process is I usually have a working title, and I would say in terms of, you know, some secret sauce, my secret sauce is just writing a ton of headlines. I just write, and I keep writing, and I try not to be satisfied. CoSchedule has a headline analyzer.
Mm-hmm. And then there's YoRocket as well, Brian Dean's new plugin.
I'll have to explore that. There's that, and then there's an emotional value. I can send you the link. There's an emotional content analyzer for headlines. So,
oh, that'd be great, yeah.
I use those, but not necessarily, they don't make the headlines for you.
Right.
But what they do is they gamify the whole thing. So they give you a score, and of course you're trying to bring your score up. And what it does is it forces you to just keep writing headlines, you know?
Yeah.
You write 15, 20, 25, 30, 35 headlines. And after you write that many, typically there's one that's good.
Yeah. A lot of people do want to hear that there's some kind of trick And
no, I wish there was. I mean, yeah. I did some templates in the book. So the book has a chapter on headlines. It has 50 templates that have like blanks in them.
Yeah.
And the reason I did that is because I leaned on those at the, in the early years. I needed those templates so that I could learn how to structure a good headline. But you do, like, I never look at those templates now. I don't look at them, you know?
Yep.
You get to a point where you start to be able to think what will work and generate it out of your own head. But in the early days, I needed those templates.
Yeah.
And I'm
in your camp too. And you speak about persistence on another podcast you're on. Somebody asked you what's your kind of your best trait, I think was the question. And you mentioned persistence. So that applies to you for writing titles, right? Like how many titles would you say you draft for a piece of content? 25, 50?
I would say between, it's less now because I think I'm better at it. That's the thing. Yeah. So, but I would say at a minimum 15, bare minimum.
Yeah.
Sometimes I get lucky and on the 15th one, I hit on it, right? But, you know, the first 14 are basically just like unclogging the pipe. Right. You know, you just, right. It's like you get all the cliches out of your system and all, you know, the first thing that pops into your head is generally the worst thing that pops into your head. So you get those out of your system. And then eventually you hit on something that actually is kind of interesting. Yeah. You know, the effect that I'm always going for is, that sounds interesting. And, you know, people want to click on it.
Creating a curiosity, perhaps.
Right. Absolutely. And one of the things I say in the book is, you know, if you have two ways, there are always a couple of different ways of saying something. So a post that says how to get your brand new kitten's undying affection will always get more clicks than how to make your kitten love you by giving it food, water, and rest. Hmm. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
What's
the difference there? What's good about one and...
Right. So the difference is you're creating curiosity, but you're not giving away the answer.
Right.
So you're making a promise, but you're not giving away the answer in the headline.
Right.
Headlines really, they need to make a promise.
Yeah.
People have limited time, so you need to promise them that reading the post will be worth their time. And that's why, you know, becoming unforgettable, that's kind of a big promise.
Yeah.
Even though it's a 79-year plan, it's, you know.
And I like the use of the word unforgettable as opposed to memorable.
Yes.
You could have used memorable.
Yeah.
But it's almost like the unforgettable part of that makes it even more interesting and more curiosity. I mean,
the star of that post, I have to tell you, this is between you and me and all your listeners. that post that you mentioned, the 79-year plan, was something that I wrote as a guest post when I was a guest writer for Copyblogger and I wasn't part of the team. And when I submitted it, they gave it a completely different headline.
Oh.
And normally, I was totally fine with headline edits.
Yeah.
Like they were experts. I was still learning. But in the case of that particular post, the headline that they gave it really gave it a different feel than what I was trying to say with the article.
Mm-hmm.
So all these years pass and they end up putting me in front of, you know, in charge of the editorial team. And we have a process where every so often we republish posts.
Yeah.
So this one came up and I said to the editor, are you okay if I rewrite the headline? Because it was like this thing that I had wanted to fix all along and I didn't really have a way to fix it. So
I did.
I was able to rewrite the headline. So that is a fresh new headline. That is not the original.
That's great. I was
happy with it too. Yeah. It better reflected what was actually in the post.
It's probably a very satisfying feeling to be able to do that. So
it was a satisfying feeling for sure.
I want to talk a little bit about the first sentence. So we talked about the title gets the click, but you have an article on convince and convert, and I'll link to that in the show notes. What are the elements that make up a good sentence? Or maybe conversely, what are the mistakes you see in first sentences in articles?
The biggest mistake that I see is people just don't pay enough attention to it. In the book, I'm like, I know this is ridiculous, but there is a whole chapter in this book on the first sentence. It's kind of ridiculous.
Wow.
There's a whole chapter on the first sentence. But I think it's that important. I mean, once you have that click, I always tell people when you're writing, you need to imagine that somebody is hovering with their hands over the back button, like they're ready to click away, and you have to pull them into your content. And the way you do that is with a really engaging first sentence. It can't be too long and wordy. It needs to grab them right away. And one of the things that I recommend is taking people into a story or getting them involved in the action from the very beginning. That's a great way. Or just saying something slightly, maybe a little controversial or surprising. Anything that will get their attention and make them, you need them to keep reading at that point and not click off.
The thing that I always see that I used to do it all the time, but now I see it and it bothers me a little bit, is when people use these kind of stock emptyless phrases like gone are the days, and that's how they begin the article. And then I instantly feel my brain just shutting off. Like,
yeah, you just feel the energy drain right out of you. Right. Yeah. So yeah, I think it's very important not to start with a cliche at the first sentence. It's just a waste of words. I mean, you have an opportunity to grab people, and a cliche is like the wimpiest way you could try to grab them. So you want to avoid that.
I agree. So we talked a little bit about creativity. You mentioned you're a fan of processes. There's a quote that you said in the Try Biz School podcast, I'll link to it in the show notes. You said, creativity really flourishes when in a structured environment. So can you expound on that a little bit?
One of the things that I talk about in the book, and again, this is a concept that I worked out in public in that 79-year unforgettable post that you talked about, is Pablo Picasso. I'm a huge fan of his work. People have different opinions about the way he lived his life, but I'm a huge fan of his work, and I've seen a lot of it in person. And in person, it's so interesting because you can actually like see his fingerprints on his work, which is really cool. And it's just, it's impressive to see it in person. And what I began to notice when I saw his work over time is that not everything that he created was a masterpiece. Because he created it, it's all collected nowadays, but he just created a ton of work.
Yeah.
And the way he did it is he had a structure and he worked hard. So what I tell people is, think of your content as a creative act that you will do on a structure basis every day. So you need to have a set of tools that you use. You need to have a time set aside. You probably need to have like a consistent location where you can reproduce the environment that works best for you. So that's like the lighting that you prefer.
Sure. So it's more like exercising. It's like a routine.
It's a lot more like exercising. Yeah. And one of the things I say in the book is, you know, there are certain things that we do in our lives as adults that we don't have to think about that much, like washing our clothes or brushing our teeth or, going to the grocery store. Yeah, let's hope. Everyone listening here, I'm pretty sure you've mastered the teeth brushing, right? So, and the thing is, like, I go to a hotel and I don't forget how to brush my teeth. I still know how to do it. So I believe that when you set up these work habits in one location, it's easier to transfer them somewhere else and get the job done wherever you are. But if you create like a supportive environment for your work and you have your tools close by, it's just so much easier to get the work done.
So translating that to the online world as writers, people that are writing or doing any kind of online work, maybe it's having a, in Chrome, I have different users set up in Chrome, and I can switch to everyone, and I'm immediately logged into certain accounts and certain tabs open up. So maybe just having an online space that you can just turn on and just be in your work right away. Is that something that you do as well with your setup?
Absolutely. You can do that. In the case of writing a piece of content, it may be just the opposite. You may need to turn off everything,
right?
Log out of everything. I mean, it just depends on how you work. If you work better when you have a lot of stuff open and a lot of stuff going on, you kind of have to know yourself and honor what works for you.
Yeah.
So I know some people who prefer to work with music on in the background. Other people need complete silence. Some people would prefer to go to a coffee shop that's busy and has a lot of activity. Other people would find that terribly distracting. So I think it's, you know, supporting your creative process, getting to know yourself, and also like knowing the time of day that works best. So do you create best late at night, first thing in the morning, right after, like for me, it's after my second cup of coffee has kicked in. I'm like, okay, now I'm ready to write.
Yeah, I can relate to that. So I want to shift a little and talk about Copy Blogger, the removing of the comments, the redesign, and what went into that. So just to give the listeners a little bit of history here, a little bit of background. So in March 2014, and you were not with Copy Blogger at this point, which you told me, they decided to remove blog comments. That truly broke my heart, and I know it broke your heart too. And a lot of sites did this, search engine land, I think. A lot of people were doing this. I actually wrote a post on Moz in early 2014 talking about how commenting was this lost art and lost metric that people had really lost track of and were focusing on all these other metrics when, to me, and I'm sure we'll get into this, but I think commenting is a true reflection of people using and appreciating and enjoying the content and engaging with the community. So I was certainly heartbroken when I saw that. But then I went to Copy Blogger a month ago or so when I contacted you and I saw that the comments were back. And then I discovered your article entitled Welcome to the New Copy Blogger. We'll link to it in the show notes. The comments were back. You talk all about it. So let's start there. Why are you such a champion of comments, and what eventually led to Copy Blogger deciding to switch these back on?
Right. Well, I think part of the reason for turning them off is that, and as I said, this happened before I was part of the team, but from what I understand, there were a tremendous amount of man hours were going into just managing comments, managing spam comments, making sure legitimate comments didn't get stuck in spam, and then marking as spam comments that were just like borderline, not really okay. So part of it was just that there were, it was a smaller team at the time, and there were not enough people on board who could help with that. And there were a lot of comments coming in March 2014. I mean, the commenting environment was kind of different than it is today. There was a huge volume of comments. So they took them off, and it did break my heart. It broke my heart because as a guest writer, one of the things I looked forward to most about writing posts for Copy Blogger was seeing the feedback in the comments section.
Yeah.
It was a very quick and obvious way for me to tell if what I had written had struck a nerve. Mm-hmm. If there were no comments or just kind of generic, oh, great post comments, which it's not that that's bad, but it doesn't, it's very minimal information, right? But when people would take the time to write a paragraph or two about what they enjoyed or ask a question, I loved that. I love that feedback. And when it was gone, I missed it terribly. So, you know, fast forward, they asked me to join the team a few months after that happened. But when I first joined the team, I wasn't on the Copy Blogger side of the business. I was helping with the Rainmaker platform.
Yeah.
Creating education around the Rainmaker platform, helping to reconfigure the onboarding process for new customers and all of that. So I was doing that at first. And then when they brought me over to the editorial team, basically the first thing I said when they asked me to manage the editorial team was, okay, but I'm going to want to bring back comments. So yeah. That's really important to me.
You settled on a nice compromise, I think, which is they're on for 7 days and then they get closed. So you can discuss
They're actually on for 14 now. We had them for 7 at first and we're up to 14 now. But that ended up working out. And, you know, that's just a word. We're on the Rainmaker platform on Copy Blogger. But Rainmaker platform is built on the infrastructure of WordPress, and that's just a WordPress setting. You can set up your posts so that, because that was the other thing, Copy Blogger has been around since 2006, so we have 10 years of content. And that was the other thing that was difficult, is people weren't just having to manage the comments on that week's post.
It was
they were managing contents on 9 years of content. Yeah. So that helped a lot. That helped a lot. It was just, it's like an opportunity. Okay, you know, here it is. It's new. If you want to talk about it, you have a chance to talk about it, but then it closes up. So that did, it was a compromise, but it's worked out really well. It's been very manageable.
That's great. Yeah. One quick aside for all my SEO fans, listeners out there. And as I told you before we recorded, I'm always looking at my guests' traffic in SEMrush. And I might just be looking for something here. This might have nothing to do with it. But to remind all the listeners, Google actually has said twice now in the past couple months, comments are a ranking factor. So comments indicate community, and community is part of their content quality algorithm. So, and I've like I wrote in this Moz post, I've thought this and said this for years. I think comments are a huge factor, not only directly because there's comments on the page, but because it creates these repeat visits, longer stays, interaction. So I think there's so many ripple effects that comments have, but I did notice that this could be totally not aligned with the internal metrics that you have a copy blogger, but at least in SEMrush, which anyone can see publicly, they show a dip in organic traffic just a couple months after the comments were removed. And then there's a sharp increase the same month that the comments were added back. So maybe I'm just looking for connections here, but at least in my biased view, I admittedly biased, I see a little bit of correlation here with ranking. So that's super interesting to me. I wanted to ask on your end, though, even just sort of anecdotally or, you know, the feeling that you kind of get from the community, have there been positive results from the comments being back on?
I think so. I do think that the commenting environment is very different in late 2016 than what it has been in the past.
Yeah.
There are fewer people taking the time to leave comments. Part of it, I'm sure, is the fact that we had them turned off for so long. And, you know, we turned them back on in January, and you're telling me that you just now noticed that they're back on. So,
yeah.
I mean, I think that's the case for a lot of people. You might be reading it in an RSS reader or something, and you just didn't notice that the comments were back on again.
Yeah.
So part of the change in commenting environment may just be that people still have the message that you can't comment on Copyblogger. But I do see not the same volume of comments that we used to get. But I think that people are grateful to have a place to speak back to us. And for us, it feels a lot less like we're speaking from a pulpit, you know, like making right. pronouncements, right. one-way pronouncements.
Yeah.
It just feels like there's an opportunity for a two-way conversation. I really like that. And I know our guest writers like that too. They appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to talk a little bit about the UX of content and the design of content. You talk a bit about it in that article about the redesign. There's also a post at copyblogger/great web design with hyphens. We'll link to it. I want to ask you about fonts. So you switched to serif fonts. And by the way, when I worked with my dad, who's a sculptor, for a few years, I was designing plaques, bronze plaques. So I was laying out the letters. So I love that mix of sort of like, how does the actual font look design wise? But speak a little bit about why you decided to go back to serif fonts rather than sans serif. So serif is like Times New Roman and so forth. Sans serif is like Arial or Helvetica. Why the switch there, and should other sites consider, you know, one over the other?
I am a true font geek, so I should put that out there to start. So serifs are those little feet that you see on letters, right? Yeah. That's what I always call them. So that's the highly technical term. So,
yeah.
So the interesting thing about Copyblogger is they have never had a serif font before. Yeah. So it's not like we went back to something. We are trying something new by using the serif fonts. But I'm a designer, and I truly believe that the font can give a voice to your written word.
Yep.
The way nothing else can, right? Yeah. So it's a voice that you're speaking in. And when we were thinking about the redesign, this was something I kind of pushed for, and I got a little bit of pushback, and I just kept pushing until it finally happened. But yeah. The thing about Copyblogger is a site for writers and a site for readers. And serif fonts traditionally have been associated with a written word.
They're in books, right?
Right. Books, yeah. Magazines. Because it turns out that those little feet on the letters connect them in a way that actually makes them faster and easier to read. Now, online, it needs to be a font that's been designed to read on screen. So if you just take like a serif font from print and put it on the screen, which is what we saw in the early days of the web, it typically is not that readable. But if you take a serif font that is designed to be read on a screen, like the one we have on Copyblogger now, it's a very readable experience, and it has like a beautiful italic that you can see in our blog quotes. The italic version of that font is gorgeous. It's Freight Text for anyone who's interested. That's the name of the font.
And there was an article on Medium recently, and a little bit of buzz. Once in a while, like AJ Cohn from Blind 5-Year Old will bring this up, the readability of your content. And just how that can help people consume it, maybe even get you more social shares or links or more engagement. And I believe all of that. One interesting thing was this talk of the contrast between the font itself and then the background. Is that something that was intentionally worked into the new Copyblogger design?
That's a big thing for me, because I see a lot of, you know, I'm at this point, you know, like solidly a middle-aged person, you know, and the whole thing that they tell you when you're younger about, oh, your eyes as you get older, well, they're not kidding about that. So, yeah, no, I mean, you start to really appreciate clarity in general. Yeah. I have always appreciated it, but now it's like I kind of need it. So, and you do see websites where people still nowadays they're using like light gray text on a white background, or they have a gray background and they have white text on it. It's just, you know, there's not enough contrast. The thing is, you don't want to do anything that's going to slow down the reading experience, even if it looks pretty.
Right.
Because and this is a typical thing that designers are guilty of. They'll make something that looks pretty from a distance, but then actually interacting with it and trying to read it is slow.
Yeah.
So contrast is one of the things that definitely helps with that.
Yeah, it's great. I might be putting you on the spot a tiny bit here. Do you know of any ways to tell the readability of content so it's not just opinion, right? Because I can come with my opinion about a website and say, well, this is hard for me to read. And then, you know, how is that true for somebody else? Are there tools or like anything that can give a little bit of evidence behind, you know, this is easy to read, this is not, things that check the differences in colors or the font size or...
There probably is an online thing, but I'm going to give you my super low tech way to do this.
I love low tech.
Yeah. So my super low tech way to do this is to take a chunk of text, probably a page, like a good page worth, lay it out on a page. I mean, you could do this in Word, honestly. Put 500 words on a page in Word, read it and time yourself, and then change the font and read it and time yourself, and just get a feel for, you know, like which one was easier, which one flowed, which one was just, I mean, you will pick up on that. You'll pick up on if something feels like it's slowing you down, you will pick up on it.
It's almost like a nice little cruel task you can give your boss. Here, read this out loud. Time yourself.
And I'm going to time you. Yeah.
That's exactly. A great tip. I like that. So at Copyblogger, are you involved with helping to choose the guest writers?
Yes.
So yes. I know a lot of people there. It's still a huge and I think important thing, not just for link building. Of course, you get a link, but to be a guest writer on relevant sites. So are there any mistakes that people make when they're applying or trying to get a guest writing slot on Copyblogger?
Well, I should say we're not actually taking guest writers right now. So I have to like go ahead and put that out there. We have a group of guest writers who we have cultivated. We've tried to kind of cultivate their voices and their topics. We add to that group very slowly and carefully. So we in general are just telling people like, please don't send us pitches, because we're also, at this moment, we're publishing new content Monday through Wednesday. And then on Thursday, we publish a roundup post. Hmm. So there are actually fewer opportunities right now for content on Copyblogger. That's always shifting, but that's a situation now. So
is there any advice you would give to people?
Yeah. But in general on any site, and I'll just tell you what I've done, because I wrote for Copyblogger, I wrote for Constant Contact, I wrote for some other, you know, kind of well-known, I wrote for John's site. in general, I think the more you can be helpful in terms of just kind of saying, you know, this is my background. This is what I could talk about. What would be most helpful to your audience? And allowing them to, they don't have to write the headline for you or even give you a super specific topic. But one of the things that helped me to get in at Copybloggers, they didn't have anyone writing about design. And I was like, well, I can write about design. You know, that's something I can definitely cover for you. So I think if there is, if the site owner has a need that you can fill, that is always going to help. And then the other thing that I did that I'm convinced helped my cause is that I always set up my posts on my own site. And I would provide an HTML file in a plain text document that they could just copy paste directly onto the WordPress page.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then I would take the visual, you know, you have the visual editor and the text editor in WordPress. So I would copy the visual editor content that had, you know, the bolding and the italics and all of that. And I would paste that into the email. So right in the email, they could read the post. They also had the HTML document that they could copy paste to put it onto their site. And then in some cases, I was providing, in the case of Copyblogger, for example, we do our own images. But if you discover that a site owner, you know, that creating images is a barrier for them in some way, you can say, I can provide an image. Yeah. I just did all these guest posts for my book, and I had this owl character as part of the book. So that owl was all over the web during launch week because I told people I can create a background for you or create a post image that has the owl in it. And a lot of people took me up on it. So yeah. I think anything that you can do to make your guest post kind of a no-brainer for the site owner.
Yep.
And obviously, I mean, it goes without saying, but you want to give people your absolute best work.
Yes.
I used to tell people that when I write, you know, this was back in the day before I was part of the team, I'd say, you know, I always feel like when I write for Copyblogger, it's like being invited to perform at Carnegie Hall. Like, yeah. I want to bring my A game when I write for that site. So it is important. I mean, we can tell the people who have taken the time to really polish their content before they hand it over to us.
Yeah. And that's how I feel when I started writing for Moz, too, was I spent more hours than I want to admit doing my first few articles for them. But I think it was worth it.
And so, you're a repeat writer, so it obviously was worth it.
Yeah.
I mean, it worked.
Yeah, definitely. I wish I could write on there more than I do now, but I usually do one piece of content a year for them, which is not a lot, but you don't want to know how many. When I do a piece for Moz, I end up putting 10, 20 hours into it just to go, you know.
I'm sure it shows.
Yeah, it shows in my lost nights of sleep. That's where it shows.
Oh, no.
But we have a few minutes. I want to talk quickly. We've talked mostly about Copyblogger. Tell us real quick about the various products you have on Big Brand System. And I guess, what is the value that you've received from having some products that people can actually get on Big Brand System?
It's interesting because Big Brand System, I have kept it going during these years that I've been part of the Rainmaker Digital team, but it's been kind of not exactly in maintenance mode, but that's almost as much as I could possibly do. Hmm. Plus, I was in this past year, I've been writing a book, so I just have not had a lot of time. So most of the products you see on there now are products that either... Well, they're basically all products that I created before I joined the team.
Yeah.
I have ideas for products that I want to create in the future. And I've negotiated my role at Rainmaker Digital, so I have a little bit more time for my own projects. So I'm excited that I may have time to actually develop these ideas I have in my head. But yeah. What I have now, they're very basic. It's like a series of guides, which are PDF ebooks with audio and video content that you can purchase. And they're helping people with definite pain points that I saw around branding. So identifying your ideal customer, and then as far as visual branding, finding a color palette that would work for your business, finding the right fonts for you to use, things like that.
Yeah, it's great. So that's kind of the maintenance. Now you have your book, Master Content Marketing. I've got the Amazon link here, but I know there's a, what's the link, the direct link people can go to get that?
There is a landing page at mastercontentmarketing.com.
Great. Yeah.
And that has links out to Amazon and Barnes and Noble. And, you know, it's in independent bookstores. So if you have a bookstore down the street, you can ask them to order it and they can get you a copy.
That's great. Yeah. And you've got 25 five-star reviews, all five-star reviews on Amazon.
I know. Awesome. I know. I'm waiting for somebody to come in and say, like, it's not so great.
Yeah, this is what I'm waiting for.
It
in this
hasn't
podcast.
Happened so yeah, far.
We've got 18 five-star reviews on the podcast. I'm waiting for the same thing, but hopefully, yeah. Fingers crossed. And last thing, I mentioned things as if Copyblogger was the big entity, but it's actually Rainmaker, right? So, and maybe a lot of other people getting up to date on that as well, because Rainmaker came in after, I think, as a platform. So just real quick at the end here, tell us what Rainmaker is exactly. And I know there's like a podcast platform. Like, so what is Rainmaker?
Yeah. So it's actually, the official name is Rainmaker Platform. So people can find it at rainmakerplatform.com. And there's a nice tour at that website so they can look around and see everything it offers. Rainmaker Platform is basically our answer to people who want to have an online business and have everything under one roof, everything they need to run that business. Mm-hmm. So, and it was created by a bunch of people who used a myriad of patched together tools and plugins and all these different provider solutions that you ended up spending like an inordinate amount of time to make work. So we decided to come up with this all-in-one product so that people could focus more on serving their audience and not so much on the technology and the tools. So it's a hosted solution. So people are paying to have their site securely hosted on very fast hosting. And it has all the tools that you would need to create digital products, sell them, offer them on landing pages. We just incorporated email marketing. So email marketing is part of it as well. Obviously, content marketing and social sharing is part of it too.
Yeah, and podcasting too.
Yeah. A-B testing is built into it. Mm-hmm. So it has, there is a learning curve. I always tell people there is a learning curve, just like there would be with any piece of software. And as you can imagine, a piece of software that does this much has a learning curve.
Yeah.
But once you scale that learning curve, people become lifelong fans because it's just, there's nothing else like it that has everything in one place. It's so much easier. You literally can go from thinking about a product you want to create to having it set up within a few minutes. Oh, it's amazing. Yeah.
So rainmakerplatform.com, people can go to that. And so other than the Rainmaker and your book and the big brand, where can people find you online? What's your Twitter or your chosen social profiles?
I do spend a lot of time on Twitter. So that's at Pamela I. Wilson. Mm-hmm. I'm on Facebook. Big Brand System is on Facebook and I don't spend as much time there, but I'm on Copyblogger. I've got a ton of content on Copyblogger, so I could send you a link to my author.
Yeah, we've got the link. I'll put it in the show notes.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Everyone can check out your articles. Well, Pamela, thank you so much. Great conversation. I hope everyone took as much value out of that as I did. I know there's a few ideas I want to apply. So thanks so much for joining us. And we'll see everyone next time on Experts on the Wire. If you've listened this long to this episode and the music's even over, I've got a little bonus treat for you if you would find this interesting. I actually recorded the very moment that I discovered Pamela and actually called her and left her a voicemail. So this is how this interview happened, how I how I reached out to Pamela and booked the interview. So if this is at all interesting to you, here it is. Excuse me. Check 1, 2. I hope this is on and working. I just stumbled across a writer on Copyblogger today, Pamela Wilson, and it struck me just, this is how I like to think of guests for the show. When I stumble across someone and I just have that instant gut feeling that they'd make a great guest, and this is somebody that I would love to connect with and share with all of you, the listeners, I go on a gut feeling, I just reach out. And I went to Pamela's website here, Big Brand System, and she has her phone number. So I'm going to give her a call, see if she wants to be on the show. It's ringing. Voicemail. Yeah. Ooh, she gives me your email. Hi, Pamela. My name is Dan Shore, and I am out there in the marketing world. I just stumbled upon your article about Copyblogger bringing back comments and the redesign of the site and everything. I was on your website, Big Brand System. I run a podcast called Experts on the Wire. It's a marketing podcast. And I was just looking around at some of your articles and stuff, and I would love to have you on the show. And I don't normally see people giving their phone number as a way to contact them, so I thought it'd be fun just to give you a quick call as a way to ask to see if you'd be interested in being on the show. I will also send you an email, because if you're like me at all, I tend to forget about voicemails that I get. But my email is dan@evolvingseo.com. I will send you an email so you have that address. And if you do want to call back for some reason, my phone number is 508-963-4413. But again, just Dan Shore here asking if you would be interested in being on my podcast called Experts on the Wire. Thanks, Pamela. Well, that was fun. We'll see how it goes.